Welcome to Not Another Political Podcast. I am Will Howell.
I am Anthony Fowler.
I'm Viola Giuda.
We are professors in the Harris School of Public Policy at the University of Chicago. As always, we're going to talk today about an exciting, salient, controversial political topic, which is the recent surge of populist leaders who are passing potentially racist, potentially discriminatory policies. And we're going to talk about why they do it and what the implications of those policies might be.
We are going to build a great border wall to stop illegal immigration.
Trump wants to build a border wall, and a lot of people think that the border wall won't actually have much significant direct impact. It's not going to meaningfully change the number of people crossing the border and so forth. And so why would he do it? Why would Trump decide to undertake this fairly costly enterprise? It certainly gets lots of cheers at rallies, but is there anything else to it?
Yeah, or the Muslim travel ban.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
Those people who, those Muslims who wanted to travel into the United States certainly were directly affected, but it had these larger effects by raising the salience of what it means to be Muslim in the United States. And we want to then think through why that's consequential for our politics and for our labor markets. Viola, you had a good conversation with our colleague at the London School of Economics, Stefan Walton, about a paper.
Yes, Stefan Walton and Tarun Dhawan, they are both stationed in London. But Europe has its own share of pretty strange policies. For example, the burqa ban.
A European court has ruled that France's ban on full face veils does not breach religious freedom. That means the so-called burqa ban is legal and will stay.
Denmark has banned the wearing of face veils in public, joining France and other European countries in outlawing the burqa and the niqab worn by some Muslim women.
At the same time, this burqa ban seems to affect very few people. Very few women in Europe wear burqa in public places and seem not to benefit the majority. So Stefan and Tarun were very puzzled by why we see politicians wasting time on these policies that actually do not benefit most of the voters. And they came up with a very interesting explanation.
So there has been the spread of this type of policies who seem, maybe not officially, but at least unofficially, to target a particular minority.
So what's so special about those policies? Should we think about them as just being racist?
In one sense, we could, but it would be a little bit depressing because, for example, these policies are very popular. So what we try to do in this paper is to say, okay, let's think there is no racial animus. There must be some other things going on behind this. And that was kind of the starting point of this paper.
Okay, so what's your explanation for these policies?
So our explanation built on the idea that when you put a ban on the burqa, they become singled out as a minority in a way that they were not before. And we talk about this as raising the salience of some identity trait, of raising the salience of the identity trait being Muslims.
And why would you want to do that?
The basic idea is before you have this type of laws, you meet me, you're an employer, Viola, and you meet me, and you look at me and you say, oh, this guy, he seems relatively productive. I'm going to hire him so I can make some profit. But now there is this type of laws, and it happened that, you know, it raised the identity trait, not of Mustang in my case, but of being French. So you meet me and you hear my accent and you're like, oh, this guy is French. And that's not so great, because if I have French people, people are going to think that I'm friendly to French people. And then they are going to kind of like not want to interact with me.
But that sounds racist.
It is racist, but it's not based on any sense of animus. It's based on your fear that because you interact with me as a French, other people will see you as being tainted by this interaction.
Suppose I'm a majority firm.
Yes.
And I meet you, a French person. And you seem very productive.
Yes.
Why would I not hire you? What am I afraid of?
You're afraid that it will change your work relationship in the future. On the one hand, you could make some profit with me today by hiring me. On the other hand, if it happened that our relationship breaks down, tomorrow it will be much harder for you to find workers. Because all the American non-French workers will say, no, I don't work with this person. She's tainted. She has worked with the French people. And if I work with this person, I myself would become tainted, and I'm afraid of this.
But this sounds like a great idea for the minority firms. Now they have access to all the workers, and they compete with those majority firms that actually cannot hire whomever they want. Are you telling me those bans are actually great for, those policies are actually great for minority firms?
No, this is where there is a flip side of it. Because not let's reverse roles and let's think of you as being an Eastern European minority.
And which I am.
Which you are. And let's think of like me as an American workers and you as a minority firm in this
case. Yes, I own my own sausage shop.
Exactly. Now, the problem is that you get the same type of relationship from the perspective of the worker. That is, if as a majority worker, I start working with you, I do not get a chance in the future to work with the non-Eastern European firms. So as a worker, I also close myself from a large pool of employers by working with you and possibly being tainted by this work that I have with you. So it's not great for minority firm, because minority firm can only work with minority workers. And it's not great for minority workers because minority workers can only work with minority firms. And so minority workers end up suffering from more unemployment and longer unemployment spell.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the methodology of your paper? My understanding is you did not collect any data. You did not interview voters, workers, firms, or politicians. After all, would we expect them to tell us the truth? Probably not. So how did you come up with your findings?
I use what is called in political science, formal theory, and in economics is more referred to as applied theory. The idea is to think about first, what are the incentives? For firms is to make profits, and for workers to get employed and get some wages. And from this, we try to think about what are the structure of the labor market as if it has been understood by other people. And when we put the notion of identity on this labor, traditional labor market, with the incentives that are very basic, what is the type of output that we get out of it? And the goal is to have minimal assumptions that are extremely clear and to let kind of the logic of the model speak for itself. And discovering the massive impact that this symbolic policy can have, obviously theoretically, but still, we were shocked. I must say we were shocked. We were depressed a little bit. And so I hope that, you know, this depression can lead to a little bit more hope. I would not say I'm optimistic about it, this thing to happen, but if it were to happen, I would be very proud.
Stefan, thank you so much. This was fascinating. This was a fascinating conversation, and I think we learned a lot. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the discussion.
Viola, tell us a little bit more about how the model works and the mechanics of it. In particular, I guess the interesting part of it is, of course, we can all explain a racist policy with people being racist, but Stefan and Torin want to explain these policies through some other mechanism. So tell us how it might come about that you end up with a burqa ban or a border wall or a travel ban, even if people don't have the strong taste-based discrimination that we might think is driving these policies.
Yes, so the main point of the paper is to show that even in the world in which we have no prejudices, suppose that for some reason, I think if I hire minorities, for example, Latinos, or Muslims, then no white Americans will want to work for me. Then I might actually think twice about hiring minorities because it's easier for me to find a white American worker than to find a minority worker. So it's this self-fulfilling equilibrium where I don't even know where those beliefs come from, but once they are there in the society, it's best response for the majority workers and majority firms to behave in this way.
Okay, so you're telling a story here where there's potentially lots of possible equilibria, where given a set of beliefs about how discriminatory everyone else is, we can sustain a certain pattern of behavior. And if we all believe that everyone else is discriminatory, even if we're not, we'll never see any evidence to the contrary.
So, it's not that everybody else is discriminatory. It's not in the sense that they have a taste for discrimination. It's that they too think that when identities are transferred, that then one is tainted, and should I then interact as a potential firm and hire somebody of a certain type, my ability to hire other kinds of people are going to be affected. That's why, I mean, it runs all the way through. There's no point at which somebody has a taste. It looks like it, right? When you look on the outside and you say, all these people are behaving in ways that are decidedly discriminatory and prejudiced and racist, the equilibrium nonetheless can be upheld just by virtue of these anticipatory effects, no?
Absolutely, but I share Anthony's concerns. Although the paper is phrased this way, that actually there's zero taste-based discrimination, it's done this way because it's want to show us starkly that those forces exist in the society, it might exist in the society. But I think the best way to think about this paper, what this paper tells us about, is that suppose we start with some level of discrimination, true discrimination, like, for example, 50s, 60s, 70s discrimination against women. We did think women were not as productive as men. Then it's very easy to envision this discriminatory equilibrium. Of course, women are less productive. We are not hiring women. And then imagine the beliefs changing. Imagine men actually learning that women are as productive as they are. What this paper tells us about is that it's going to be very hard to move away from an equilibrium that's discriminatory to an equilibrium where actually women are hired the same way as men are. Because right now, even though I completely abandoned my false belief, and let's say as a lawyer, I would be thrilled to hire Ruth Bader Ginsburg to work for me, I worry that other people might not want to come and work for me if they see a woman working in a law firm. They're going to perceive maybe this law firm as tainted or maybe weak. I don't have anything against women, but I'm going to behave as if I did. So I think for me, it's a story about how hard it is to move away from discrimination, even if the basic reasons for discrimination that were
are shown to be false.
Exactly.
Can we talk about the burqa ban? So this is kind of the leading example in their paper. So the first question is that a fair kind of assumption about the burqa ban, that mechanically what's important about the burqa ban is it just raises the salience of Muslims, and so it raises the cost of being associated with Muslims in France. And when the burqa, I mean, people know who is and isn't Muslim for the most part. And if anything, wearing burqas makes it easier to identify who is and isn't a Muslim. So you might actually think burqa bans might actually go the other way. It actually makes it harder to distinguish between these groups and might, in the long run, lead to more assimilation and so forth. So that seems like one reason why this is a strange example. But it's also not obvious to me that it seems like for the burqa ban to even get some political support, there already have to be lots of people who don't like this group or think of them as an outside group. Think about the wall, for example. Do you think Trump coming out and proposing a border wall, does that generally make all Americans less willing to be associated with Mexicans?
To the extent that it raises the salience of being from Central or South America, it's about the symbolic qualities of building a wall is to say you are on the other side. And who the you are is a social marker that then may have implications for hiring and firing decisions that are above and beyond the changes in the composition of the workforce that also may be affected by the introduction of a wall. That's the part of the story that Stefan and Torin are trying to grab a hold of.
Here's just out of curiosity. So here's one possible interpretation of what happens when Trump proposes the border wall. You can tell me how well does this fit with their paper or not. Suppose what happens when Trump proposes the border wall is, one, there are a bunch of liberal progressive white people who say, I don't like that. And if anything, it might actually make them want to go hire Mexican Americans and want to, you know, want to help this discriminated against group. Another thing that can happen is there could be a bunch of people who already have discriminatory attitudes toward Mexicans, let's say, and people from Central America that are coming in through the Mexican border. And they now feel empowered to speak openly about those discriminatory views in a way they didn't before. When Obama was president and this wasn't out there, out in the open, they kept quiet, they kept it to themselves. And now, hey, Trump is our president, he's saying it on TV, I can say it too. And let's go have the march, and I'm going to yell it, you know, when I see someone I don't like on the street. I think that's a pretty common interpretation of what's going on right now in some segments of American society. Could that be fit into their story, or is it a totally separate story?
I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the effects of these policies is to make people come out and say, yes, I actually don't like minorities and so on. But I think the interesting insight that the paper gives us is as follows. If indeed those symbolic policies push us towards discriminatory equilibrium, if indeed minorities lose at the end, we might conclude that actually most of Americans are racist. We might say, well, you know, if we weren't racist, we wouldn't discriminate. But what they are saying is that perhaps actually the situation is not as bad as we think it is. Perhaps what Trump did with his wall is he woke up a few racists who expressed their racism explicitly. But at the end of the day, we all fell in line because we felt that if we don't, we are going to suffer economically. I think what I like about this paper is that, yes, I think it doesn't disprove all these explanations that you're putting forward. And I agree with you that they probably are valid explanations. But I think what they tell us is that we don't really have to have a lot of racism, a lot of prejudice
in order to be incredibly racist.
So Trump doesn't have to believe that most Americans are racist. He just has to believe that some of them are, and they are going to come out, and then they are going to snowball this effect. They are going to now make us even more attuned to racial
differences.
And assign significance
to those differences. Yes. And in this sense, it's not clear that this is not a happy story at all. Right?
No.
Right? This taste-based story would suggest that, well, no, there are lots of people who want racist policies, and therefore, to the extent that we want to combat the racist policies, we need to attend to this massive population. But what they're coming in and saying is that, well, no, all you need is a few of these people, right, potentially to get it going, to have there be some sanctioning effect, and that can carry through the entire population, right?
Yes.
It's pretty awful, actually. Given that a symbolic policy is adopted, that they recognize that there could be a non-discrimination equilibrium or a discrimination equilibrium. But we have no sense of the likelihood of one or the other or how we move from one to the other. So
yes.
How as a game theorist do you think about equilibrium selection?
So that's actually one part of game theory where I don't think we have made a lot of progress for the last few decades. It's, you know, once we are in equilibrium, we are in equilibrium. It's optimal for me to behave the way I behave, and it's optimal for you to behave the way you behave. And unless one of us sacrifice themselves and changes our behavior, we are stuck. So it's very hard to think about how we move from one place to another.
Or how do we begin playing one versus another?
Yes, we have some theories on that, but there's nothing that everyone would agree with. I think that's the biggest weakness of the paper, that they try to tell the story that is the symbolic policy that moves us from one equilibrium to another, but I agree with Anthony that that's just a story. There's really nothing, no theory, no science behind it. But I want to point out that their paper goes a little bit beyond what we have discussed so far. So, for example, they say, look, if you buy our story for a second, that it's the symbolic policy that moves us to the other equilibrium, then what you should find is that politicians who propose those policies at the same time will also propose to lower redistribution, lower taxes, and lower government's spending on social programs. If we believe that a symbolic policy is going to move us to this discriminatory equilibrium, the minorities will suffer, but the majority will benefit economically. Once there's higher income inequality, the majority does not see it useful to pay taxes because the taxes will not support whatever they want to get out of the government, but a big chunk of the taxes is going to go towards minorities. So there's much less support for redistribution. You know, we don't know whether the symbolic policies do change the equilibrium, but we do see, at least the authors have some examples, that politicians propose symbolic policies and at the same time propose lowering taxes and lowering redistribution. So I find it suggestive that there's something to their story. It's not a proof, but at least it's something worth thinking about. I just want to bring your attention to one other aspect of the paper. So what they found is that this discriminatory equilibrium can occur only if the minority is sizable but not too sizable, and if the minority is not well integrated economically. What that means is that we should see that there might be some minority firm owners, but not too many of them. Okay, and one can see a logic of that. If there are too many firm owners that are minorities, then actually it's even harder for the majorities to find jobs if they cannot work for minorities, so they are not going to find it profitable to shun the minority firms. I think this actually lets us understand certain historic facts. So, for example, if you think about the discrimination against women or discrimination against African Americans, this discrimination persisted for a very long time. Long after you would think that we got rid of most of the taste-based or statistical discrimination. And that would be consistent with their model. They say this equilibrium just exists even if we don't have any statistical discrimination. When you think about other minorities that were historically discriminated against based on taste discrimination, such as LGBT community, for example, you see that actually the labor market discrimination against them disappeared very quickly. I'm not saying that it disappeared completely, but you sort of see differences between African Americans, women, and LGBT discrimination in the workplace. And you can say, well, it's consistent with the model. They are a small minority, so shunning them out of the market is not really going to help the rest of us. At the same time, they are economically integrated. They are firm owners. They are powerful people in entertainment or in politics. So they say, yeah, so this equilibrium is not going to benefit anyone, hence it's not going to be praised. It's not going to be an equilibrium in the first place. And again, I don't want to say that they explain the history of discrimination, but I think it's yet another point that makes me pause and say, yes, I share Anthony's concerns about different parts of this paper, but it's actually speaking to me in some sense. It's making me think about certain facts from our history differently.
There's something of a trade-off when we evaluate this kind of work between, on the one hand, being kind of clever and saying, look, I can look what outcomes I can explain by making a set of claims that have no bearing on the actual world, on the one hand. And on the other hand, the upside is to then reveal aspects of a world that we wouldn't otherwise see, or to force us to question assumptions. There are times when looking at a model, you can say, look, I can explain the history of discrimination in which there is no racist, and there are no racists whatsoever. And I think one concern is that, like, that's being too clever by half. If you want to get to the crux of the matter, when you want to think about racism and its effects that emanate through politics and the economy, the place to start is with the long legacies of bigotry that are rooted in ideas about what they call taste-based or statistical discrimination. That's the place to start. And that this then can feel at times like, well, again, being a little too clever by half. Is that?
Yeah, I've got several layers of things to say, I think. So one place to start is, one way to think of the model is just as a model of labor market discrimination. Yes. And ignore the symbolic policies for a second. Like, you've got a model of how labor markets work. And do we think that's a sensible model or not? It's got some merits to it. It certainly seems to explain some empirical things that we see in the world. It also explains why maybe we used to have a lot of taste-based discrimination and we got into this bad equilibrium and then it's very hard to get out of potentially. So there's some value in the paper just in doing that. If you then want to take that model and say, now I'm going to use that infrastructure to explain symbolic policies, symbolic discriminatory policies.
The condition under which they're adopted.
I actually don't think they've made a lot of progress there because that's all a black box. In their model, symbolic policies are just suppose the government can magically push a button that increases the cost of being associated with minority group. When would they do it and when would they not do it?
How do you mean it's a black box? Because they identify particular conditions under which a majorities in a population would support the adoption of
I'm not even sure if there is such a button that the government can push. Is it really true the government can just magically push a button that all of a sudden makes it more costly to be associated with this minority group? I'm skeptical that that's even true. And by supposing that it's true, you've kind of proved too much. And so that wasn't really an explanation for anything. That's just saying if the government did have such a technology available to them, here are situations under which they would use it. That still doesn't really answer the question of why does it work for Donald Trump to go race baiting? Or does it work?
Or maybe it doesn't work.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't think they would insist that those policies work. I think what they would say is that, you know, now once we know that we can have this equilibrium, we can sustain this equilibrium that benefits majority, and majority of the population would like to play this equilibrium, then the governments will try.
It's hard to imagine governments doing this without there already being lots of animus in the population to begin with. But if there is no animus to begin with, it's hard to imagine the government just, you know, the president just coming out and making an announcement or passing a policy that's all of a sudden going to...
But they give you a model that shows there are conditions under which majorities will want such policies. They will want it not because of animus, but because they see them benefiting from the heightened salience of a social marker that they don't currently have and its implications for the labor market.
Part of the reason why it's hard for you to imagine that is because you have not this model in your head before. So before the only explanation was...
It's true because
there was this very easy explanation available to us, which is people are just racist. We fell back on this explanation every time we saw this kind of policies. And what they do is they come and they say, well, you know, let's pause for a second. We give you a different explanation. You might not buy it, but it at least should make you think twice before you jump to the conclusion that people are just racist. And that's why we see burqa bans and walls being built. They are not trying to tell us what's true and what's the right explanation. But I think they made me at least think a little bit more about the conclusions I jump to when I see the symbolic policies.
When you say that they're not trying to show what's true, I think what you mean by that is they aren't trying to provide the single definitive explanation for why all countries all the time adopt symbolic policies.
Yes, exactly.
That's not what they're doing.
Exactly.
But the paper is decidedly true in the sense that the propositions are mathematically correct, and there's no arguing with that.
That's correct, yes.
Thanks for listening to Not Another Politics Podcast.
Our show is a podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy and is produced by Matt Hodapp. Thanks for listening.